Hi everyone. If I haven't met you, I'm Robin Berger. I'm blessed to be senior pastor of Wellspring. Thank you, Sam, for sharing. That was really powerful. I do feel some pressure now because this is like a famous passage, right? And everyone said it's really, really good. So the sermon better be really, really good. Thanks, Sibin. Sam even used the phrase, oh, that's good. That's good for me. Thank you. Sam used the phrase during our pre-service prayer, it's going to be a rip snorter. Come on, that's funny. If I could have that picture on the screen, though, thank you, William. I wonder whether you can compete with Mark Wahlberg and his hyper-efficient daily schedule. Just look at how much he packs in. Can you see this? He wakes up at 2:30 a.m. He has prayer time. He has breakfast. He has a workout for over an hour and a half. At 5:15 a.m., most of us are in bed and we're not getting up for another few hours, right? He has a post-workout meal at 5:30. He has a shower. It's curious, his shower seems to go for an hour and a half. I've watched videos on YouTube that say he doesn't stay in the shower for an hour and a half, but in any case, he then has a 7:30 golf, maybe a practice rather than a game. He only goes for half an hour. A snack at 8 a.m., that's when most of us are having breakfast. He's already been up almost 6 hours by this stage. He has something called cryo chamber recovery, presumably to help him with all of the workout that he has had and will have for the rest of the day, because he just keeps exercising. A snack at 10:30 a.m., remember he's been up for a whole 8 hours by this point. Some family time, meetings, work calls for a couple of hours. The funnily titled lunch at 1 p.m., though he is really due for dinner in terms of the amount of hours he's been up for. 2 p.m. meetings, work calls. He picks up the kids from school. Family man, how lovely. A snack at 3:30, eating a lot. 4 p.m., another hour's workout. Shower at 5, more dinner and family time. He goes to bed at 7:30 p.m. I mean, can you handle that? I can't handle that. If you tried, well, just tell me if you do try, and I'll laugh at you while I go back to sleep. This is ridiculous. There's part of me that wonders, Mark Wahlberg's seeking to make the most of his time. That's how some would see it. Others would say Mark Wahlberg is seeking to control his time with minute precision. Which is it? And will it make him happy? If I implemented this schedule, would it make me happy? You would have heard this refrain during our Ecclesiastes series, this chasing after, right? And for you or someone you know, this focus tonight on time might be the most persuasive case to cease the chase. Why? Because everyone, Christian or not, must contend with time. There are some phrases we use all the time, pardon the pun, and you might have even said them or heard them this week. I feel like there are not enough hours in the day. I've wasted my week. That time's gone quickly. How can time accelerate? I've got really bad time management. That was a good way to spend my time. Time is money. I wish I could have my time again. Each of those statements touch on this paradox. We talk like we can control time, but it's actually a fact, a gift, not a variable, and not a tool. And surely Christians have something to say about this. The Christian worldview does have something to say about this, because as it says in chapter 3:11 of Ecclesiastes, God has put eternity into your heart, not just yours, every human heart. I think about memory traces that Tim Keller, the late Tim Keller, talks about this. Every human being has a memory trace of the Garden of Eden. Though it was millennia ago, our first parents lived a life whereby they had perfect harmony with God and all creation. And it's still there. We're broken and fallen, but there's still a little speck of memory inbuilt to us when life and time, in this case, was perfect, not rushed. We had enough. It felt eternal. It felt spacious. There was a sense in which we weren't stressed or broken down by time. And yet, since the fall, when everything breaks, time hollers at us with stress. There's either too little of it or too much of it to get through. It either goes too fast or not fast enough. I'm sure you've noticed human beings are really bad at sitting in rather than accelerating whatever season they're in. We're bad at contentment. That's a phrase that's come up a little bit in this series so far. Psychologists and sociologists tell us this as well. That Mark Wahlberg type advice is, like, and so you can crush your schedule like Wahlberg, is fine if all hours are equal. That is, that we all have 24 equal hours. We don't. Writer and artist Jenny O'Dell, she's from the US, I was reading her during the week, and she says, there are obviously things we can do to become more efficient in what we're doing, but you and I run up against the hard reality of having more or less resources and more or less support when it comes to our time. She's exactly right, because Mark can only do this because he has resources and support. He has a private gym. He has childcare for his kids. He has different types of food he can ingest at his different snack points in the day. He has a secure home, not a threatened home. He has money. He has great vast sums of power. So 24 hours, all of us have them, but are they all equal? O'Dell also cautions us against thinking about time as a material, like money, because that's what we can do. We think of time as, I spend it on you. Oh, now I have less because I gave it to you. It doesn't take too long to figure out that's a really dangerous way to think about our time and our relationships. So could we not help our friends and neighbors, let alone ourselves, connect the dots between all of our yearning for a good relationship with time and the God whom we believe created it and gives seasons? I think so. I think tonight's going to help us. What we'll focus on in this Ecclesiastes 3 passage is the permission it gives us for every activity under heaven to exist. That's what verse 1 talks about. A time or an occasion for everything. Nothing ignored, nothing cut short, nothing undervalued. And what I'm going to argue is this, that if we accept life's seasonality, if we know the times, we can expect a timeliness to everything, which will show we're not in control and we have no power, and therefore we can stop chasing. As we've already touched on, these poetic contrasts in verses 2 to 8, famous, they're on Instagram posts, they've been made into a song back in 64. They're on people's bodies as tattoos. They're certainly on fridge magnets. What is it about these seasons that Solomon, the writer of Ecclesiastes, wants us to understand? Well, he's trying to cover everything, isn't he? We're meant to see not one human activity falls outside time, which is the same as saying not one human activity falls outside God's sight, control, and power. Whatever sort of time we're experiencing with its various bits and pieces, it falls somewhere within these 14 seasons, 7 pairs. Let's have a look at them for a moment. Think about yourself. Whatever time of life you're in right now, you can likely group it under at least one, probably more, of these 14 seasons, these 7 contrasting pairs. And there's something really cool here about the way Hebrew language works. It's done in the other parts of the Old Testament as well. By setting up two extremes, by saying something like, you know, There's a time to weep and a time to laugh. Solomon's including everything in between. So not just that extreme, time to weep, or that extreme, time to laugh, but the melancholic seasons. Or the seasons when you're sad but you're not crying. Or the seasons when you're apathetic. Or when you're glad but you're not laughing, and so on. Hopefully you see what I mean. That's by way of introduction. So time is a great entry point in talking about chasing in life, what we're chasing, and also that all seasons between the two extremes are in view. And if my inkling is right, if there's a sense of timeliness to all seasons, this really challenges those of us who want to chase power and control. One of the key questions a lot of people I meet have is this: how do I know which season I'm in? But let's think about that for a moment. Isn't that another way of trying to wrest control back? To speed up the season if we don't like it, or to prolong it if we do? We want to control the seasons. But that just ignores the fact that seasons are something we go through rather than have power over. So that could be the wrong question. Perhaps it's a better question than, how do I know which season I'm in? Because verse 1 is quite matter of fact. There is an occasion or a time for everything. Where do those times and seasons come from? They come from God. Back in chapter 2, verse 24, Solomon would put it like this: a person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. This too, I see, is from the hand of God. So, as I said, if my contention tonight, God has created the world with a timeliness to everything, if we believe in seasonality, we'll do three main things. Here they are. One, we'll ask, what is God doing in this season? That's a better question than, what season am I in? One of the huge cultural gaps between our world and Solomon's world is an agricultural one. So you can go into an Australian supermarket, you get tomatoes all year round, and so you don't have any signal that this is a summer fruit. The only possible one is that you're paying $10 a kilo in July for what costs you $4 a kilo in, say, December. But life back then in Solomon's day was different. As an agrarian culture, farmers, and by extension everyone else, had to humbly surrender to what the season required, when the season required it. So they didn't have to ask, how do I know which season I'm in? The soil told them. The harvest told them. When it was time to plant, farmers obviously didn't reap. When it was time to reap, it was a terrible time to sow. They humbled themselves to what the season required. This is what I was getting at earlier in talking about time and timeliness. Solomon is teaching seasonality, but not just as a given, but as a gift. You know what I mean? He's teaching it as a portion. He's not saying, oh, just get used to it, this is how it is. This is God's design, is his point. These seasons are granted by the one who has power over them. Each season is timely. And we know this to be true when we upset the order and rebel against the season. I'll give you a few examples. You know, imagine God has granted a season to you of planting, building, searching, mending. But then you hit the snooze button. What's going on? You've decided not to work when it's timely to work. Or God's given you a season of refraining, of giving up, of throwing away, being silent, being at peace. But then you take work home with you and do more hours than you ought. You've decided to work when it was timely to rest. Or it's time to heal, dance, love. But we're caught in bitterness and resentment against someone who's hurt us. We've decided on death when it's a time for life. Or it is time to die, a season to uproot, to weep, to tear, to hate, a time for war. And yet we say everything's okay. So we've chosen pretending rather than being real. Heed verse 1 again. There is a time for everything under heaven. And so no matter what time it is, we've got to learn to adjust to it on the basis of the hope and purpose that God is in it. That verse 11, God has made everything appropriate or beautiful or fitting in its time. Love that word fitting. That's the literal translation. God has made everything fitting in its time. One writer has put it succinctly. With God, everything fits. Nothing is wasted or lost. I love that. With God, everything fits. So we learn the obvious question that we do ask, oh, how do I know which season I'm in? There is a better one. What is God doing in this season? And let's be honest, our answer to that comes down to whether we trust him. Whether we trust him. Many of us can handle loose ends and unknowns and bumps in the road, but the reason we cope is we trust the people involved. Think of the husband who has to move interstate because of his wife's new job. Will this be a season of dying or being born, of weeping or laughing, of mourning or dancing? He doesn't know. But he doesn't agree to move because he's sure of the season. He agrees to move because he trusts his wife, he trusts God, he trusts that things will be okay. What is God doing in this season? At the very least, you and I have reason to trust him when we look at Jesus' death and resurrection, right? So for Christ, there was a time to die and a time to be reborn. His whole life story shows this submission to the seasons out of love for the Father and for us. So you can trust God. If he turned his own son's death into life and life eternal, you can trust him and submit to the seasons of his hand, fitting in their time. So that's the first certainty you'll notice. If you believe in life's seasonality, you will notice, and if you surrender, I should say, rather than control, if you believe that you're not in control and don't have power, but God does, you'll ask God, what is he doing in this season? And hopefully you'll trust him. Here's the second thing about accepting life's seasonality. We'll find ourselves personally and socially prepared for changing times. What do I mean? We'll be prepared for changing seasons, like Paul was. Have a listen to his inner world. He unveils it a little bit in 2 Corinthians 4 and 6. Have a listen for how he is poised to deal with changing times. And think, does this describe my heart, my state of preparation for changing seasons? We are hard-pressed on every side, but not crushed, perplexed, but not in despair, persecuted, but not abandoned, struck down, but not destroyed, sorrowful, yet always rejoicing, poor, yet making many rich, having nothing, yet possessing everything. How did he do it? See, he was holding the tension rather than fixing it. He had a way of living that encountered each season on its own terms, with realism, not with alarm. He accepted, in other words, life's seasonality. He would put it in Philippians 4, famous section, I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, living in plenty or in want. I can do all things through him who gives me strength. Another out-of-context verse. The context is very important there. Content, that's actually a really good word. We won't explore it in detail tonight, but that's what we're talking about. If you accept life's seasonality, you'll be prepared personally for changing times because your default setting is contentment. The opposite of contentment, we can say, is chasing power and control, wrestling time to the ground like an enemy, wishing to be in a season other than the one you're in. Courtney Rice, an American writer, she's speaking particularly to women, but it's very helpful across the board. The ultimate mark of womanhood is hoping in God, not giving birth or loving a husband, though these are beautiful privileges. God declares us women, created in his image, valuable in his economy, and given a great singular purpose to display his glory in our specific season. We are not on hold, dear sisters. I love that phrase. We are not on hold. I want to encourage you tonight in case you feel like you're discouraged and constantly waiting for the corner to turn for a new season and then things will be better. Okay. You're not on hold. God is doing something in this season, something profound. You don't have to wait for it. And I think that leaves at least another challenge with us. Have you ever thought about this passage as being a personal rebuke? I didn't until recently. Because God is declaring in Ecclesiastes 3 that speakers must sometimes be silent, that laughers must give themselves and others permission to weep, that the searchers must sometimes give up searching, that the haters must love at some point, that peacemakers must allow for war at some point, and on it goes. I wonder, as you looked at those 14 seasons listed on the screen before, which are you most comfortable with? Which have you least experience with? It will help you understand if you are personally prepared for changing times. That's the personal preparation. What does it mean to be socially prepared for changing times? This is about how we relate to one another in the midst of life's seasonality. Basically, if you accept life's seasonality, you will be the opposite of Job's friends. Story of Job, you've been looking at this in Resonate in recent months, I know. His suffering was unimaginable, going from having everything to having nothing because of a cosmic deal between God and Satan. And his friends watch on and are aghast. They actually visit him to console him. They see him, can't even recognize him, and then sit wordless for a week in the ashes with their friend Job. That was a good start. They knew and read the times well. They got the season. It's a time to be silent. It's a time to mourn. But then they started mismanaging the seasons. Their social handling of changing times was off. They began debating reasons for Job's suffering. You might remember in chapter 2 onwards, they think the season for speaking had begun when it was still time to be silent. They thought that we could theologize about this when they really just had to weep with him. They actually turned this into a condemnation. God's done nothing wrong with you, have Job. You really should search your heart because you must have done something wrong for all this suffering to come. He calls them in chapter 19, miserable comforters. A mismatch of seasons can yield great pain. If you misname the suffering of someone else, if you think it's a time to laugh, or clearly not many of us would, but some of us have been guilty or been on the receiving end of someone telling us to perk up, maybe even telling us accusingly, you must have done something wrong. Well, God doesn't think that. And he actually had some harsh words for Job's friends. Back at the end of chapter 42, or start of chapter 42 of Job, he looks at Eliphaz, one of the friends, and says, I'm angry with you. and your two friends. You've not spoken the truth about me. So see how this bears out the wisdom of Ecclesiastes 3. There is a time to mourn and a time to dance and a time to be silent and a time to speak. And you got to manage the seasons well. We're social beings. We don't want to be a discourager when we are called to be an encourager. We don't want to be an accuser when we're called to be a friend. So it's wonderful how Solomon guides us wisely to read the times well and be prepared to be friends who give timely advice. Here's the last thing. I said that earlier, verses 2 to 8 are taken out of context all the time. They are. The reason I wanted in the larger section of chapter 3 read out is because the last couple of verses that we hear in this passage are really important. It gives us our third point. Those who surrender power and control of the seasons to God are left with this encouraging conclusion. So have a listen again. This is Ecclesiastes 3, verses 13 to 14. There's also the gift of God whenever anyone eats, drinks, and enjoys all his efforts. I know that everything God does will last forever. There's no adding to it or taking from it. God works so that people will be in awe of him. The truth is, not one of us can stand back and take it all in. As you looked at that list of 14 seasons, hopefully in a good way, you were overwhelmed. You and I can't see the whole picture, and we don't need to. What's so good about God is he sees everything from beginning to end. That's not in our power. He does it so that we'll be in awe of him. The seasons, then, are a gift. Eating, drinking, enjoying our efforts. This life is not a stopgap, and it's not a bewildering mess and mystery. We get this privilege, an assignment to live God's way in God's world if we'll surrender to how he orders it. We get to participate in stuff that he does that will last forever. So we've got to stop chasing and start trusting. And that will start with prayer. So let me pray. Lord, we want to pray forgiveness for the times when we have sought efficiency rather than obedience, quick fixes rather than depth, when we've rebelled against the seasons that you've given with discontentment, with envy. We also confess that we have often thought ourselves to be in control, having power over the seasons. Tonight we want to say sorry, we were wrong. We affirm this truth. You give the seasons as gifts. Sometimes they're hard to bear. I want to pray tonight for anyone who is in a season, a time of weeping, mourning, of things being uprooted, taken away, who are in seasons where they feel it will never end. In these moments, we want to pray particularly, bring those folk back to the cross and resurrection of Jesus. You could turn dead things to life there. Would you do resurrection, powerful things in these, our brothers and sisters, struggling in this season? I want to pray for those of us who feel we are on hold. We're just having to wait until the next thing to emerge. Help us be obedient to you in this season, whatever it is, knowing that there is life and life to the full through Jesus. We lastly want to thank you for the liberty and the freedom not being in charge. We ascribe greatness to you. Sovereignty to you. We surrender and say we know very little. As it says elsewhere in Ecclesiastes, God is in heaven, we are on earth, so our words will be few. Amen.